You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12s. This is Corbin Smith, host of the Locked On Seahawks podcast, alongside Rob Rang, closing in on a really exciting upcoming Week 7 matchup between the Seahawks and Ravens. We'll open up today's show discussing the return of Earl Thomas to Seattle and what to expect on Sunday. In the second quarter, it's time to look back at Seattle's past five matchups with Baltimore. Yes, a somewhat brief history here. And then we'll wrap up the show, Rob and I, looking at what's new with the Ravens, who went through plenty of changes this offseason personnel-wise. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. Rob, it's been all over the headlines the past couple of days. It's been circled on the calendar, and it almost makes you forget that there are two very good teams that are getting ready to compete at CenturyLink Field on Sunday. But Earl Thomas will be making his much-anticipated return to Seattle as a member of the Baltimore Ravens. A lot to unwrap based on yesterday's press conferences and as well as some things that were said today.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's really a story that kind of threatens to take away from the importance of this game for both clubs. But, you know, anytime that you have a member of the Legion of Boom coming back, that's obviously going to be a dominant story and one who has as many spectacular plays in Seahawks history as Earl Thomas does, then that it deserves to be something that we talk about a lot. And I'm very excited to see what the Seattle crowd, how they react when Earl Thomas returns to CenturyLink.
Really curious. I'm with you. I'm curious to see what the fans do, how they respond. Based on what I've seen on social media, I'm not sure what to expect. I've seen plenty of people that have been saying Earl Thomas, one of the best players in Seahawks history, I'm going to cheer him like crazy. And there's been plenty of people saying, I remember what he did the last time he came off a field in a Seahawks uniform, and he lost all of his respect for me, so I'm going to boo him. So I guess we will find out which part of the crowd wins out in the game Sunday, and if those people that are claiming they're going to boo actually are going to boo. Thomas hopes they respect what he's done and he gets a few cheers. He admitted he's thought about this quite a bit. How are the fans going to react with him coming back to Seattle? But he is insisting that he's going into this game as if it's business as usual. His emotions haven't hit him yet. I don't know how much I'm buying that, and I'm sure as the week goes on and we get closer to the game, it's not really going to be business as usual anymore. When you consider how things unfolded the last couple years there in Seattle, first off, the mistake he made going into the Cowboys locker room and telling Jason Garrett to come get him, and then we know the Cowboys didn't do that. They didn't offer the money to get Earl Thomas, didn't make a move there. So that ended up creating some strain between the team and the player. And then a big holdout last year, was out all of training camp, all the preseason, comes back playing like an all-pro the first four games, then gets hurt, leaves on the cart, leaves an unfriendly gesture that eventually he admitted was for Pete Carroll on the sideline. And unfortunately, that is what everybody is going to remember as the last thing he did in a Seahawks uniform, when he did so many incredible things for this football team. So you can understand why some fans are upset at him. That being said, I don't think booing him is probably the right thing to do when you consider how much he impacted this team positively on the field over the years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I certainly, just having been as close to athletics for as long as I have, then I get it. You know, it's a game of incredible emotion, and Earl Thomas played the game with as much emotion as any player I've ever seen in my life. And so just recognizing, I mean, he recognized the injury for what it was, that it was going to be a season ender and that it very likely was going to be a career ender in terms of at least his time in Seattle. And so I understand why he reacted the way he did. I think Pete Carroll understood the way that he reacted and basically defended Earl Thomas after the injury, after being flicked off across the sideline. We all saw exactly what happened. At the same time, I would just ask those fans to recognize that as well, just the emotion and the spectacular things that Earl Thomas did throughout his career in Seattle, rather than one emotional moment. And Earl Thomas, in my opinion, is a Hall of Fame player. Doug Baldwin, I thought, said it best. When he got caught in a post game interview on Q13 Sports, if I remember correctly, explained it very well with what a player the Earl Thomas is. And I always go back to his college days. I thought that he would struggle at his size being able to play the free safety position. I thought it was something that it was just going to require too much physicality. I had him pegged as a first-round pick as a cornerback just because that's the remarkable athletic ability that he has always demonstrated. I think that he could have been a spectacular cornerback if that's the way that he had gone. But, you know, I just always come back to the fact that, you know, some of the most dynamic plays in Seahawks history were the result of number 29. And so when he gets announced, or if he is announced, then I certainly will be, you know, giving my respect to him. But at the same time, once the game begins, then I think that Seattle has to try and take advantage of the emotions that Earl Thomas is going to be feeling, and see if they can get him to bite. And because he is prone to some of those types of emotional mistakes on the field, he does trust his eyes, and sometimes they can get himself in a little bit of trouble. And I think that the Seahawks know that better than anybody, and so I believe that Russell Wilson should be able to take advantage of that situation.
I cannot wait for this matchup between Wilson and Earl Thomas, because obviously these two have been going at it at practice for years, and they have incredible respect for one another. Just hearing what Earl Thomas had to say yesterday, he said, "I'm always going to have nothing but positivity in talking about Russ. When you think about all the games we played together, there have been some times when he struggled, but there have been more times where he came through for us when we needed him." And he talked about, you know, hoping that all that experience he had in the practice field against him pays off in this football game. But you got to wonder, Russell Wilson, he knows Earl Thomas pretty darn well from those times practicing too. Are there some things that he maybe can pull out of their experiences practicing against each other? Like you said, maybe I can take advantage of his instincts and his aggressiveness and make him bite. And that's something that, as great of a player as Earl Thomas is, he has done a few times in his career. We know how good Russell Wilson is at manipulating defenders with his eyes, his movement in the pocket, things like that. Could this be a situation where Wilson is able to exploit some of the strengths that Earl Thomas has that can play against him at times? So I really feel like this is going to be one heck of a chess match between the quarterback of the defense and the quarterback on the offensive side of the football, Wilson going against Thomas.
There was just so many times that they practiced against each other, and the fact that they used to watch film together early in their careers. But at the same time, Earl Thomas is a player who, again, will trust his eyes. He will go for the candy at times. And that was one of the things that, you know, my conversations with some of the folks in Seattle's scouting staff, their coaching staff, over the years, is that Cam Chancellor was often the safety who would help Seattle get lined up from the back end. That is often a case of the free safety being asked to do that, but not so much in Seattle. And so Earl Thomas was the guy that can get himself in trouble that way. And I thought that it was interesting that when asked about some of the safeties that the Earl Thomas kind of reminded him of, Pete Carroll talked about Troy Polamalu. And Troy Polamalu is the exact same way. Absolutely terrific player, Hall of Fame player. You know, of course, the Pittsburgh Steelers, but previously Pete Carroll at USC. And the same kind of a guy that you want to just turn him loose because he is so instinctive. He is going to make a lot of plays for your defense. But at the same time, he's also going to make the occasional mistake. And as you just articulated, Corbin, you know, that's one of the things that Russell Wilson did such a great job of this year. I mean, still the only quarterback to start every single game this season has yet to throw an interception. To me, this is the game where Earl Thomas is such a dynamic player with such terrific hands, such terrific range, that he might be able to stop Russell Wilson's streak. But at the same time, I think there's also very much possibility that Russell Wilson, Tyler Lockett, and DK Metcalf are able to take advantage of Earl Thomas's willingness to try and go for the big splashy play and instead be able to beat him with some misdirection plays as well.
Much like Richard Sherman coming to Seattle last year, it's going to be quite a spectacle seeing a former member of the Legion of Boom come back in another uniform, this time going against Russell Wilson. It does feel like there's a little different tone with the way that teammates are talking about Thomas than they were about Richard Sherman last year. Not that Sherman still doesn't have relationships with Seahawks players, because he certainly does. He and Bobby Wagner are still very close, but it just feels like there's been a little different tone in regard to how the Seahawks have discussed Earl Thomas compared to Sherman a year ago. Going to be a lot of fun to watch how this unfolds. Peloton is offering a limited time offer. Get $100 off accessories when you purchase the Peloton bike and get a great cardio workout at home. Go to onepeloton.com and use promo code LOCKED to get started. When we return from the break, the Seahawks haven't played the Ravens very many times, but they've had a lot of success against them in recent years. We'll revisit the series history between both franchises. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Welcome back, 12. This is the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, alongside Rob Rang. Later in the third quarter, Rob and I will be taking a look at what's new for the Ravens after a pretty busy offseason. But before we can do that, it's time for a bit of a history lesson. We're going to go back and revisit Seattle's series history with Baltimore. This actually is just going to be the sixth time these two teams have played each other. Obviously, the Ravens were the Browns before Art Modell moved the team in the mid-90s. So if we accounted for that, it's a much longer series history. But the Seahawks lost their first two games against the Ravens. They have since won the last three matchups, including both times that they've played the Ravens with Pete Carroll on the sidelines. Now, Rob, looking back at the second-to-last game these two teams played against each other in 2011, this, to me, was a game that was very important in the rise of the eventual Super Bowl teams in Seattle. The Seahawks winning 22-17 over the Ravens at CenturyLink Field, and this was viewed as a huge upset. Seattle was 2-6 going into this game. They were the bottom feeders in the NFC West. They didn't have a franchise quarterback. They were trying to stay afloat with Tavares Jackson, and we know Charlie Whitehurst got a little bit of action that season, too. Baltimore, on the other hand, they were 6-2, and they were looking like a possible Super Bowl contender. So this looked like an absolute mismatch, and yet the Seahawks were able to pull off a huge upset.
Well, they were, and a big part of that is the fact that, of course, that they did play at home, where you know Seattle has had such a huge presence with the 12th man for so long. That definitely helped, and then they also did something that, of course, Corbin, you and I have been preaching since day one with this team. They ran the damn ball. You know, Marshawn Lynch, that's what I remember about that. He had 32 carries in that game, only 109 yards. You're averaging only 3.4 yards per carry, and yet you stick with it. Then that, to me, is the foundational piece to keeping a game manageable, especially if you feel like you're being a little bit overmatched in terms of talent. Because as you said, Baltimore came into that game 6-2. Seattle was 2-6. It looked for all purposes on paper that Seattle was going to get crushed. But, you know, again, you run the ball with Marshawn Lynch. Lynch wound up being the team's leading receiver, both not only in receptions, 5, but also in receiving yards with 58 in that game. And so because of that, Seattle was able to kind of control the clock, control the game, and win it the good old-fashioned black and blue style that the Baltimore Ravens had previously made famous.
That's what's crazy about this. The Seahawks beat the Ravens at their own game. And to me, like I mentioned, this was a very important game in building this team into an eventual playoff team and then eventually winning a Super Bowl, because really this was the start of getting that identity going, establishing that identity. We are going to be a physical, run-oriented football team. They had Tavares Jackson under center, and there were a lot of games that year where Jackson really played the role of game manager quite well. In this one, he went 17 for 27, 217 yards. He didn't throw any touchdowns, but most importantly, did not throw any interceptions. So he was taking care of the football, and they were able to ride Marshawn Lynch to get some points on the board. Steven Hauschka had 5 field goals, so they weren't able to finish a lot of their drives maybe as they hoped to. But when you're the underdog, if you can get a bunch of field goals like that and your defense plays well, you've got a fighting chance. And this is the other thing that's really interesting from this game. The Ravens' top receiver that day was a guy by the name of Ed Dixon. Seahawks fans, I'm sure, know who he is now, but 10 catches, 2 touchdowns. He was the one guy that was giving the Seahawks defense trouble, but this was one of the first games Earl Thomas, Cam Chancellor, and Richard Sherman all started together, and they combined for 4 pass breakups in this game. That's part of the reason they were able to hold the Ravens to 17 points that day.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy you mentioned that. I mean, that, you know, it just seems like it's the perfect time to mention with Earl Thomas returning that was the start of the Legion of Boom. And of course, we're going to see Earl Thomas returning. And you could say that that's kind of the end of the Legion of Boom. But it's always kind of nice to reminisce. you know, the game I remember the most, Corbin, is, of course, and I'm showing my age here, it's the more recent game, and that was the one where Russell Wilson really kind of started off just playing at times at MVP level, and that was in this last game when Seattle played Baltimore. They were very much more on the hot streak. Seattle ended that game at 7-5, whereas Baltimore was struggling a little bit. They were 4-8, and Russell Wilson went absolutely off. 5 touchdowns in that game, and 3 of them to Doug Baldwin, 2 of them to Tyler Lockett, very much the opposite of the game before, where they were throwing the ball rather than running the ball down Baltimore's throats. And, you know, that's what a little bit more of what I kind of think we might see here in this game. And it's not that I don't think that John Harbaugh and Pete Carroll certainly want to run the ball, just that you have 2 MVP candidates right now in Russell Wilson and Lamar Jackson going head-to-head. I think there is going to be a little bit throwing the pigskin in this game.
Prior to this season, that was the best Russell Wilson had ever played in his career. That second half of that 2015 season, the final 7 games, Rob, 24 touchdowns, 1 interception during those last 7 games. He was unconscious. He completed over 70% of his passes. And, you know, this is a team that kind of had to make some changes to their offense anyway, because the one downer about this game was that Thomas Rawls injured his ankle in the first half. And he was lost for the season. I still believe if Rawls doesn't get hurt in that game, I know there's your crowd out there say running backs don't matter, but I truly believe with Marshawn Lynch being shelved then and really wasn't healthy when he came back, wasn't ready to go in the playoffs, if they had Thomas Rawls, I think that's a huge difference maker for them in the playoffs. So that was the one downer of this game, is you did lose your starting running back who had really come on strong. Who knows what happens that season and beyond if he doesn't get hurt there, but they lost him in that game. And so Russell Wilson had to shoulder the load a little bit more. And like you said, he did that and then some. 292 passing yards, the 5 touchdowns, 3 different receivers, Baldwin, Curzon, Lockett, combined to make 19 receptions for 160 yards and 5 touchdowns. So this was not one of those games where Wilson was spreading it around to, you know, 20 different receivers. He had 3 guys that he was throwing to almost every time and just absolutely annihilating the Baltimore Ravens defense. And the poor Ravens defense, they had to worry about, you know, we got to try to hold Russell Wilson under 20 points to have any fighting chance, because Jimmy Clausen is playing quarterback for us. So that made life much easier for the Seahawks defense. Michael Bennett, Cliff Averill with 9 quarterback hits combined in that game. Richard Sherman with an interception. Really, things just got ugly very quickly for the Ravens. This one got away from them, and then Russell Wilson made them pay.
No, he certainly did. I mean, one of those terrific performances of his career. As you mentioned, the 292 passing yards and the 5 touchdowns. I mean, he completed 23 of 32 passes. I mean, so that's only 9 incompletions. He was averaging 9.1 yards per attempt. Any time that you are averaging more yards per attempt than you have incompletions, I mean, that's just a mind-boggling statistic. I mean, you can't do that on a video game. You know, and to be able to do that against a defense, I realize this wasn't the great Baltimore Ravens defense of old, but this is still a darn good defense. Even in Baltimore, when they're bad, their defense, it seems like, still plays well. And so it truly was one of those remarkable performances that kind of showed that Russell Wilson was not just the game manager, as some have incorrectly, kind of explained him to be, that he was going to be a future All-Pro. And, you know, in this case, this season is very much showing that he is an MVP candidate as well.
Yeah, that was really a precursor. The last couple of years, there's been issues with the pass protection, and the defense has lost a lot of different players, and Wilson still put up huge numbers last year, and now he's just taken another step forward. But really, if you wanted to see what the precursor to seeing that he could play like this was, it was that last 7 games there where he was arguably the best quarterback in the NFL for the second half of that season. It's time for a quick break. When we come back, Rob and I are going to take a closer look at what's changed in Baltimore. Plenty of other changes aside from simply adding Earl Thomas. We'll investigate what's new when we return. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. If you found $100 on the street, would you pick it up or keep walking? Of course you take the money. So why do you keep picking winners and not betting on them? That's why I go to MyBookie. It's fast, it's easy, and they pay when you win. Let's face it. Where you're betting is just as important as who you're betting on. I wouldn't be telling you guys to bet with them if they weren't the best. Do the smart thing. If you're going to bet this football season, bet with MyBookie. Did you know you could bet on games after kickoff? If by the second half it looks like your bet is going to lose, you can always just take the other side. If you're the kind of guy that likes to bet a little and win a lot, try a parlay. If all your picks come through, you'll multiply your winnings, and no matter what you bet or how you bet, the NFL season is the best time of year. Join now and MyBookie will double your first deposit. Use promo code LOCKEDON to activate the offer. That's promo code LOCKEDON. Visit MyBookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm Corbin Smith alongside my co-host Rob Rang. We've already reached Thursday. These game weeks just fly by. It's time to look at what's new with the Baltimore Ravens, a team that got back to the playoffs last year with a rookie quarterback, and now they look poised to take another step forward in 2019, currently in first place in the AFC North with a 4-2 record. Rob, they didn't make a ton of additions, but the guys they did bring in free agency, obviously the biggest one being Earl Thomas, but they were able to add Mark Ingram, who gave them a dynamic running back in the backfield, and just a couple days ago, upgrading their defense a little bit by trading for Marcus Peters.
Yeah, I think those, all three of those are absolutely huge additions. You know, it's, in today's era, modern era of football, you know, free agency can get kind of crazy. You see teams who make a splashy trade or sign some player, Cleveland Browns, you know, or do these kinds of things that you think, oh wow, they're gonna be the team to beat because they signed some player, and it takes some time to develop the kind of camaraderie and rapport with teammates. But all three of the players that you just mentioned, Corbin, have come in and. Well, at least in the case of Marcus Peters, I expect him to play well, just like he did at the Rams, and obviously with two Pro Bowl seasons in Kansas City. I expect him to do well. Earl Thomas has made splashy plays, and then Mark Ingram has been an absolute stud for Baltimore. I mean, he's one of the NFL's leading running backs in terms of touchdowns, and that's obviously what matters the most, especially when you have the dynamic dual-threat quarterback that is Lamar Jackson. You need that punisher at the end, and that's what Mark Ingram is. He plays so similar to Chris Carson in that he is low to the ground, he's powerful, he puts people on their backsides. He's the exact same player that he was at Alabama and the player that normally New Orleans used him as. And so I'm thrilled to see the success that he's had in Baltimore, because that's one of the things that I've noticed about the Baltimore Ravens for years now, is they just do a really, really nice job of finding their kind of players and putting them in the position to succeed. And that's one of the areas that I think that Baltimore and Seattle are essentially mirror images, or birds of a common feather, if you want to say it that way, together.
Yeah, normally both these teams don't shell out huge bucks to bring in free agents from outside. That's why I was surprised when the Earl Thomas deal went down. The Ravens weren't even being discussed as an option. The Chiefs were considered the front runner there, and of course the Cowboys had continually been thrown around, but it became apparent they didn't have the salary cap room to make a contract work out with Earl Thomas. So the Ravens come swooping in with a 4-year deal, over $40 million, and they paid him. And so that's not something they've normally done. Usually they make really good thrifty signings in free agency, and I think Mark Ingram's going to turn out being that. He already has been with the 7 touchdowns that he scored, and I like to now use Mark Ingram kind of as a tale for people that look at running backs that come into the league and they just assume, well, you're a running back, you should be able to come in and be great right away. Ingram was kind of a slow starter earlier in his career with the Saints, and he had to split platoon carries with a number of guys, Alvin Kamara most recently, but he was really productive in the Saints offense after his first couple seasons in the league. It seemed like he really just turned the corner, and now he's playing at a potentially all-pro level for the Baltimore Ravens. So it's one of those tales that just because the first year or two maybe doesn't work out, that doesn't mean you just throw the running back out the drain. The guy still has a chance to really turn things around, and Mark Ingram has done that. Now he's playing like the guy you expected him to be coming out of Alabama. Now, on the defensive side of the ball, the Ravens lost a lot of key pieces. Clearly, Earl Thomas was brought in to replace Eric Weddle. I would say that that's probably an advantage for the Ravens at this point. Weddle's still a very good player, but he's lost a step or two. Earl Thomas still looks like he can fly around the field. So they were able to upgrade their safety position, but their pass rush and linebackers, that's a little different story. CJ Mosley going to the New York Jets, getting the what was then the most expensive contract for a middle linebacker, Bobby Wagner, a few months later, ended up beating that out for the Seahawks. They lost Za'Darius Smith to the Packers, and he's been a great addition for Green Bay, one of the best free agent signings that we've seen this offseason. And then Terrell Suggs, he's still getting the job done here. I've said this a few times in the show. He's kind of like, your best fine wine. He just seems to age extremely well, continues to play at a high level. Arizona's been glad to bring him in. So the Ravens have missed him in their pass rush. It's been a little bit of a struggle for them getting after quarterbacks.
Yeah, it has. And that's the thing, is that anytime you are, you know, going to allocate dollars to free agents to bring in, then you're going to lose some players. I think that they would have certainly loved to have kept the linebacker Mosley, but you know, you can't pay them all, unfortunately. And so that's one of the losses that they were going to have. They have some talent at that position. I mean, but at the same time, nobody like Mosley or some of the other players as you just mentioned. And to me, what it really comes down to is who is going to be able to kind of step up for them. I look at some of the linebackers that they have on this team, like Josh Bynes, the guy that, you know, his days back at Auburn, he is a physical tone setter kind of a guy, but he's not the kind of guy that I think is going to be able to match up athletically with what Mosley was in the past. And so that's something I think that Seattle is going to take advantage of. And you know me, Corbin, I mean, I'm always going to focus in on the rookie class. And that to me is where I'm really excited to see how the Ravens are going to be able to perform in this way. Because Marquise Brown, he's that same type of speed wide receiver that has given Seattle troubles in the past, whether it be John Ross this past season or some of the other receivers that we've seen in prior years. We talked about that. We thought that Cleveland was going to try and get Antonio Callaway going. And of course they did try to get him going, and Seattle was just successful in kind of limiting the damage in that way. It remains to be seen if Brown's going to be able to play in this game. He's been struggling with an ankle injury, but if he is able to play, he's again exactly the type of guy that's given Seattle problems. Hollywood Brown is he's one of those guys that lives up to that nickname. I mean, he is all flash and dash, and so he's somebody to be concerned about. Miles Boykin was a player that, you know, you and I talked about leading up to the draft, that might be a guy that Seattle would be interested in just because he had such incredible workout numbers. And then, you know, remember we talked so much about Jazz Ferguson. Well, Jalen Ferguson, his brother, wound up being one of the Ravens' top pass rushers. So if they're looking for somebody to be able to try to replace, some of the ones that, as you just mentioned, that Baltimore let leave in free agency, then Jalen Ferguson could be one of those guys that perhaps gives Seattle a little bit of problems off the edge as a rusher.
Yeah, Ferguson hasn't done anything yet up to this point. He's been dressing for some games, but he hasn't made an impact as a pass rusher. But I anticipate at some point this year, Baltimore is going to try to get him more involved. Hollywood Brown has clearly been their best rookie, but as you mentioned, this is something dating back even to college. He's had issues staying healthy. He's a smaller receiver, so it's not surprising there have been some durability concerns there. So it remains to be seen if he's going to be able to play in this game. If he does, that creates some issues for the Seahawks defense, because he is a very talented, explosive athlete on the outside. And he and Lamar Jackson already have pretty good chemistry going on. Miles Boykin's been a nice surprise for them. He's a guy that I wasn't sure was going to be able to come in as a rookie and be able to contribute that much, because I thought he was really raw coming out of Notre Dame. And I still think this is a guy that has an incredibly high ceiling. Just didn't know about how much he would be able to impact games right off the bat. He's been able to do that for the Ravens, and they need those two guys to produce, because you look at the rest of their receiving core, it's not anything overly exciting. I think they got a couple guys that you can count. Willie Snead's a guy that's going to put up decent numbers every year. Nothing flashy. He'll get open and make some catches, but not a star by any means. They just don't have a lot of studs in their receiving corps. So Hollywood Brown has been a really nice addition for them. So has Boykins. And they also have a running back by the name of Justice Hill that hasn't gotten a ton of run in the regular season, but something that's interesting about him, he was the guy that was in front of Chris Carson on Oklahoma State's depth chart. Carson was not their starter when those two were both playing for the Cowboys. It was Justice Hill, and he had a really good preseason for the Ravens. So he's another guy that can come in and give them some snaps at running back, that can be really explosive out of the backfield, can catch the football. So they've got a lot of balance back there. They've got two or three really good running backs that they can hand the football to. And Pete Carroll was talking about this yesterday. The Ravens, he loves the way they play because, quite frankly, they are nearly mirror images in a lot of different ways in how they handle games from a philosophy standpoint. They love to run the ball. They like those explosive downfield pass plays, and they typically win games with their defense, at least in the past. They're well-coached defensively with John Harbaugh and his staff.
Well, and I loved that you mentioned Justice Hill and the fact that Carson was the backup there. And to me, that's a very similar situation as what you were talking about before with Mark Ingram and how he kind of struggled out of the gate going from the downhill I formation kind of running attack that is Alabama, at least when he won the Heisman Trophy. And then he went to New Orleans. And, of course, you have Sean Payton and Drew Brees. They want to throw the ball. And so that's the same thing at Oklahoma State with Mike Gundy as the head coach. Chris Carson, who at the time was not considered much of a wide receiver or much of a pass receiver, I should say, obviously at the running back position, but that he has kind of morphed into more of a complete back in Seattle because he's been given the opportunities, whereas Justice Hill is very much more that classic Big 12 slashing running back that does have the burst, has the agility to make people miss in space, and is a very good receiver out of the backfield, but doesn't run with the ferocity that Chris Carson did. That just wasn't a great fit in Oklahoma at Oklahoma State, but has absolutely been a terrific fit here with the Seahawks. And so, to me, those are some of the interesting things about this game. I absolutely agree with you that they are mirror images of each other. There is one other player that I have to mention as far as being kind of a breakout guy. It's not really a new player, but the tight end Mark Andrews has become very much a big-time player for the Baltimore Ravens. He's only in his second season, but he was actually drafted. He was the second tight end that the Baltimore drafted a couple of years ago behind Hayden Hurst, but he already has the same number of catches, the same number of touchdowns, and he's having a terrific season so far. And he's a guy that I think that we talked about before in the last game that Seattle played against Baltimore, that Dixon, that he was Baltimore's leading receiver. We all know Seattle has struggled to cover tight ends in the past. Mark Andrews is the player that I think that Seattle has to very much keep an eye on this game. And again, he's having one of those breakout performances that people should be paying attention to.
I talked about this in our crossover show on Wednesday. He might be the guy that scares me the most on their offense, aside from obviously Lamar Jackson being able to do the crazy stuff that he can do, being such a phenomenal athlete, can throw the ball, can run as well as any quarterback we've ever seen. But Mark Andrews, the ability for him to be a mismatch at tight end, an athletic guy that can run downfield. He's way too big for your slot corners to defend against. Linebackers don't have the athleticism generally to be able to cover him. That's the kind of guy that has given the Seahawks fits in the past. Though we have seen them respond in games like this before, like they did against Travis Kelce last season, where they were able to shut down the tight end as well. So it's kind of been hit and miss. So that's certainly a matchup that I'm eager to see what the Seahawks decide to do. How are they going to defend him? Because he has been their most dangerous receiving weapon when you look at the entire season as a whole. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at CorbinSmithNFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Rang. If you'd like to be a featured sponsor for our Locked On Seahawks podcast, you can contact me, LockedSeahawks@gmail.com. Make sure to subscribe to our show, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast platform is, by going to our website, LockedOnSeahawks.com. When we come back tomorrow, Rob and I are going to be breaking down some key matchups to watch in this football game. And as we do every Friday, it's time to put together a game plan for Seahawks victory. Looking forward to sharing some insight going into this Week 7 clash at CenturyLink Field. Thanks for listening in. Go Hawks.